I'm Sarah Carradine, podcasting from unceded Gadigal land.
I'm Mari Forth.
And this is Crime Scene, the true crime review podcast where we get to the heart of how true crime stories are told. Let's open today's file. We watched Dream Killer.
Yes. And to discuss this very, very interesting documentary that was brought to us by an RHAP patron, I just want to shout out Josh Green, one half of the RHAP Out of Context account. We are going to be talking about Dream Killer, and we have the wonderful guest, a seasoned world traveler, a diehard reality TV fan. She is RHAP's chief Amazing Race correspondent, Jessica Leese. Jess, how are you?
I'm great, Mari. And I also want to thank Josh Green. And I'm really wondering how discussion of a serious true crime documentary property is going to make its way into RHAP OOC. So we're going to hope it's stable.
Well, we've already had a few, so I'm just on tenterhooks, I suppose. How many stomachs does a horse have? Who knows? Hi, Jess, thank you so much for coming on for this.
Oh, sure. I'm excited. I've been wanting to for a long time. We just haven't found exactly the right thing to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this might be it, Jess. Can you tell us, like, what is it about true crime that really appeals to you? And what is your, like, true crime story that got you really into the genre?
Well, I'm not necessarily one of those, you know, creepy, dark kids who reads the Anne Rule books at age 10. Yeah. I definitely dabbled in that growing up, but it's really been kind of the renaissance of great journalistic podcasting that has pulled me back into the true crime fold. And there's so much out there that's really well done that tells a compelling story. And I'm always here for the compelling story of it all. And you can't resist those morbid impulses. Like if something, if there's a story that's got like some really salacious or gruesome element to it, of course that pulls you in. Of course that's, you know, that's in everybody's nature. But yeah, I would say I'm a filthy casual at best. Maybe my favorite podcast, you know, don't tell anybody in the RHAP orbit, but perhaps my favorite podcast and the one that jumps to the top of my queue the second it drops is Case File. And it doesn't really matter what he's talking about. I know it's going to be well researched and it's going to take me for a ride. So like every Saturday morning, I've got Case File up and running. And I think that has been my gateway drug into a lot of other. I'm mostly a podcast person, although I read a lot of books. And so when we get to recommendations later, I'm going to recommend some books. But
excellent.
Love that.
Yeah, that's my true crime. That's my true crime arena, basically.
I love that. I don't know if I've heard of that podcast.
I've jotted it down.
That's great.
I have jotted it down. It's going to jump to the top of my queue as well. And as always, everyone, we're going to everything that we talk about will be in the show notes. It's interesting, since Mari and I started this podcast, the true crime fans, filthy casuals, experts, are just everywhere we look, everyone's interested in true crime. So this was our thesis, that it tells us about ourselves, and they can be incredibly compelling stories. And it seems like, you know, as we say, we've been telling stories for millennia, and this is just one vehicle, and people seem to really latch onto it. So today, the story we're going to look at is Dream Killer. It's a 2015 documentary feature. It landed on Netflix in 2019, and I think that's obviously where it came to much more prominence. It's produced and directed by Andrew Jenks. He was only 29 when he made this film, so a couple of years younger than Ryan Ferguson, the subject of the documentary. He has a new film coming out called Billion Dollar Babies, The True Story of the Cabbage Patch Kids. I cannot wait. That's dropping on Tribeca Online on June the 14th. So, Mari, Jess, what's the crime in this documentary?
So can we just start off on the documentary name? It's like it's Dream / Killer. And I'm like, I like how you're saying it, Sarah, like Dream Killer. Like I'm not going to lie, this has been on Netflix for a while, but it never jumped out to me. It truly didn't jump out to me from the name, from like any of the trailer of anything that I saw. Like, honestly, again, thanks so much to Josh Green. If he hadn't recommended it to me, I don't think I would have given this the time of day, unlike some of the other properties that we've talked about. And I wonder if that's kind of the case of Andrew Jinx. I think I looked him up. Not only was he young, but this is one of his first, basically his first forays into like filmmaking. So I'm not trying to just, I don't want to sound like I'm just like downing the name or anything, but it definitely wasn't what I thought it was going to be. And I'm just so glad that I watched it, because this is for the murderinos, the people who love the diehard homicides, the gruesomeness. This is what this film, these are who this film is for, because less than a minute in, I looked at it, a minute in, the real actual crime scene video, unedited, unblurred. So content warning for some of our listeners who are watching this, who might be averse to blood. I'm sorry, maybe we should have put this on our last episode, but like less than a minute in, it is the raw crime scene footage. So just be aware of that. And
I think this is a huge misstep. And one of, I have to say, I really liked this documentary, but one of the only missteps was this immediate, unedited, unheralded, and completely unnecessary crime scene photos.
It's also, it's cognitively so, like, it's totally different from the entire rest of the film. And this is interesting. This is interesting to me because the bulk of it, like, once you get past that, the rest of it's relatively dry.
Yeah. The rest of it is, it's just like a full length version of a Dateline or a 2020 in a sense. You know, not too much of the talk, you know, the narrators themselves, but I agree with you, Jess. This was the most, the beginning is the most gruesome. And I don't know if they're trying to really like pack it on the head, like the crime, because technically, unfortunately, the victim's name is Kent Heinhold. Like, he gets lost in this, you know, the victim technically gets lost in this, this documentary, because this documentary is not really objective in my view. What do you guys think? I feel like this documentary had a course that they wanted to prove that Ryan was innocent, and that was not a subjective doc at all. Jess, well, what do you think?
Is any doc truly subjective?
Right.
You have to go in knowing what story you want to tell. Mm-hmm. But I did think it was a curious choice that we don't talk about the crime literally at all for the entire rest. It's not even, I wouldn't even call this a true crime documentary. If we're really thinking about it, this is a judicial process investigative journalism documentary. This is really, the crime is the inciting incident, but this is really about Ryan's process and how did Ryan get where he is and how is he going to get out of this situation and how is his family going to help him achieve that goal? It's so not at all about the crime.
Yeah, the victim here is Kent Heinhold. He was the sports reporter at the Columbia Daily Tribune. He was found murdered in the parking lot there in November, the beginning of November 2001, sort of overnight Halloween night. And the story is that Ryan Ferguson was, as we find out, spoiler alert, wrongfully convicted for his murder because his friend Chuck Erickson, his co-accused 2 years after the murder, when there was a sort of follow-up in the press, as happens, because the murder was still unsolved. He says he's been having dreams about having done the murder. This is Chuck. Yes. That Ryan was there with him. He becomes obsessed with this. He mentions it to a couple of friends of his, and the friends feel that they must call the police, which they do. And we get that phone call from one of the friends. And thus, the documentary is set in motion, shall we say, for now. These boys were 17 at the time of the murder, and so 19 at the time of their arrest.
And if you don't mind, Sarah, I really want to hammer home kind of the first 5 minutes of this documentary, because it truly was the first 5 minutes that I was like, oh, I'm very glad that this was recommended, because at minute one, we get the gruesome crime scene photos. We then get the 911 call of was it the friend or was it Chuck Harris?
No, it was one of the friends.
We got a call from one of Chuck's friends saying like, hey, I know a guy who is saying that he may have done this murder. This is 2 years later. This is in 2003. So then it jumps to Chuck Erickson's like in the back of like a police car, like they're taking him back to the crime scene, and he's trying to say what he thinks happens. He's like, oh, there's snapshots, I don't really remember, you know. And then he was like, oh yeah, Ryan was there too. And then again, still first 5 minutes, we get Ryan talking about how like it was just a normal day, it was a regular day, I was driving, I had a great day at school, I pulled up at my apartment complex, all of a sudden a truck pulls up behind me and they're saying they're FBI and I got to get in their car. Like, and then we get the footage, the police footage of him in the police car in the back. And this is what I thought was really impactful, because I just thought of it, putting myself in that position. Can you imagine just finishing up your day? You're about to park in your home and then all of a sudden the police grab you. And not only do they grab you to arrest you, but this he stays arrested for a decade after this, you know what I'm saying? Like, and if everything is to be believed, he has no idea why they're even there, you know what I'm saying? Like, and on this police interior footage, he's really like, I don't know why you are arresting me. And the officer is like, well, your friend Chuck Erickson is talking. And he's like, about what? He's like, about that night 2 years ago, Halloween night, you guys murdered, and he's like, I don't know, we weren't there, we went home. And the guy's like, don't get mad at me, get mad at Chuck. And then we go back. This is all in the first like 6 minutes. We then get confessional footage from the officer talking to Chuck Erickson, and Chuck is,
well,
like,
if you can call it confessional, yes. I would call it feeding Chuck all the information about the crime scene that Chuck doesn't know.
Exactly. And that is exactly what I wanted to point out, because it is immediately that you're like, this is not how you can you should correctly be interrogating somebody. Because he's like, Chuck, so we know you guys did it. And Chuck is like, I think I did it, I'm not sure, I can't remember. And he's like, oh, well, you know, we got your prints there, we got the things here. And Chuck's like, yeah, yeah. And then it's interspersing Chuck's coercive interrogation with Ryan's, where Ryan is really just like, I don't know what to tell you, I was not there. He's very adamant that he wasn't there. And then the police are like, but Chuck was there, and Chuck is putting you there. And then Ryan's like, well, Chuck's lying. And then he's like, well, Chuck is putting you there. And Ryan was like, I don't even think Chuck was there. And then the police officer was like, well, which one is it? Is Chuck lying, or was he not there? And you can just see that Ryan is so frustrated, because he's just like, I don't know, I just know I wasn't there. What do we think about these like really first 10 minutes of this documentary? Jess?
I think like one of the overarching messages that the documentary comes back to, and I apologize for like going holistically and not going beat by beat,
no,
here,
no, but no, please.
One of the overarching messages that I think Bill Ferguson literally says, this could happen to any of you. Mm-hmm. And I think this does do a very good job of giving you that sense. Mm-hmm. Like that this is something you could be just going about your normal life, and then suddenly, you know, you are the subject of this intense scrutiny for something that you have no clue about any of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I will say about true crime, if you consume enough of it over the course of a few months or years, the main takeaway from it is how broken our judicial process
is.
Oh,
yes.
Mm-hmm. And this is really, especially when it comes to like police questioning, and you mm-hmm. can get this from like any random Law and Order episode, but the way that the police kind of, it is their job to not necessarily solve the crime, but to get someone on trial for the crime. And So the fragility of memory around this stuff, like the question, the leading questions they asked Chuck to get him to the conclusion that he committed the crime, and then the process by which they then were able to use that against Ryan, like there's nothing there, and they make a lot of something out of nothing.
Exactly.
Yeah, and neither of these young men have representation in the room. It's just apparently one police officer, and then there's a moment where they finish talking to Ryan and another police officer appears from off camera, and you think that man was in the room the whole time and he wasn't on camera. I'll just jump to the back of Ryan's mother Leslie's T-shirt, which she wears throughout the 10 years. A friend had a dream in which he was involved in a murder. After hours of harassment, Ryan stands by his word, claiming his innocence. And then she says, no murder weapon, no physical evidence, no DNA, no eyewitnesses, no connection. There were fingerprints at the crime scene, but they were not Chuck's or Ryan's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And and like Sarah correctly pointed out earlier, in Chuck's interrogation video, the officer even says at one point, there's one piece of information that I've kept from you. What was Kent strangled with? And Chuck says, I don't know, a shirt or something. And the police is like, well, we know it's not a shirt. And Chuck says, maybe some rope or bungee cord from inside his car. But I don't know why he'd have that. The cop says, you know, we know that it's not a bungee cord or a rope or anything like that. And he says, we know that it was a belt. Did you see Ryan with a belt in his hand or something that looked like a rope or a cord? And then Chuck was like, yes, yes, it was a belt. It was a belt. Ryan had the belt. And it was just like... I feel like that's all you needed. You should have been able to show the jury, and, mm-hmm. and they should have thought that was ridiculous.
Well, jumping ahead, they did show the jury, and the jury said, we can't see it and we can't hear it. It was too fuzzy. It was on a projector, such as I remember right. from school. And yes. the jury said, we can't see or hear it. That trial was horrifying. Just yeah, we this, have to get it. This defense attorney. We could literally go minute by minute, but let's jump to the trial. One of our main narrators is Bill Ferguson, Ryan's father. He's very, very clear, and he's very helpful to us to take us along. But let's go to Ryan's trial with his defense attorney, Charles Rogers. Charles Rogers, Jess.
Jesus. Yeah, well... You know what they say about the person that, you know, it's the old joke about the person that graduated last in her class in medical school and you can call him doctor. Mm-hmm. The same, like, you know, you can call this guy Esquire. He was really like, there were a lot of things that there's a lot of boats that he missed.
I actually thought when we were watching, I mean, unbelievably painful watching the footage from the trial mm-hmm. With this man. I thought it was going; they were going to go for ineffective
counsel,
advice of counsel first, yes, which they never did. I mean, they never did.
I'm surprised at that.
He called Chuck Erickson Mr. Ferguson at one point, who's his client. He had a map that was incorrectly labeled, which Bill Ferguson had told him was incorrectly labeled, and he still took it. He had the interrogation tapes projected onto this, you know, pull-up mm-hmm. screen projector that the jury said they couldn't see or hear. He did nothing about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're laughing, but it is horrifying.
It is.
I actually thought, was he having absence seizures? Because he had moments where he just completely stopped and didn't say anything.
Yeah. Kind of like, where was I again?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it was really weird seeing this footage in the documentary. Like we said, you know, we're going to do all full spoilers here, but you can always watch the properties that we talk about because it's always good to watch them, because this was truly like he would be in the middle of a sentence and kind of just forget what he was saying or where his line of questioning was going. And I thought that was unbelievable from the start. Like, they should have just see if they could have switched him out or gotten him like an assistant or something just right out the gate. But so that's his ineffective defense counsel. But
they never took that line. Yeah. Though. They never took that line.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm calling him ineffective. They didn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you ever see the movie Sleepers?
Yes.
I did not.
This guy is Dustin Hoffman in Sleepers. Like, they purposely, yeah, the trial in Sleepers, they purposely hire an incompetent defense attorney so that they use like ineffective counsel as an argument, as I recall. It's been a while since I've seen it, but yeah,
it's been a while since I've seen it, but yes, yeah. I like that comparison. A good movie. Pop that on your lists, everybody. I mean, the interesting thing about the trial, and we will move on from the trial in a moment, but Chuck Charles Erickson comes in to testify. He's in prison, I mean, almost like a costume from a community theater play about criminals, a black and white striped jumpsuit. He is handcuffed. And I mean, it's a fantastic move by the prosecutor, Kevin Crane, not one of our favorite people, because the jury is obviously going to think, why would you say that you killed someone if you didn't? Right. And that thought alone, which Kevin Crane comes at from all different angles, is enough to make this young boy seem very credible. And he is saying that Ryan was there. He is one of the eyewitnesses. The other eyewitness is a very brave woman who does come forward later, called Shauna Aunt. She was the janitor of the Tribune. She came out and glimpsed two white men calling out and walking away from the scene. And she did a composite, which, it must be said, looks startlingly like Chuck Erickson. Now, nobody's saying that Chuck actually did it, but that was one of the things that played on Chuck's mind, was this composite looked very much like him. But she said 100% she told Kevin Crane it was not Ryan Ferguson. So when she's on the stand, Kevin Crane doesn't say, you know, do you see the person who did it here in the courtroom, and can you point them out, that very famous moment that we see in all the movies? And because Kevin Crane didn't ask, Charles Rogers, Ryan's defense attorney, also didn't ask. And because she was a young woman at the time, 19, she says she felt very terrorized by Kevin Crane in the preparation. She said she was not going to volunteer any information she wasn't asked for.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we cannot understate how, like, these two boys, they would have been 17 when the crime occurred. They were between 19 and 20 when this trial happened. So a lot of these people, the witness, Shauna, was 19 as well. They're very impressionable because, of course, like, even Ryan at this point, I know he has to be thinking, I didn't do anything. So, you know, eventually everybody will see I didn't do anything. That's normally what a lot of wrongfully convicted people say. They're like, they know deep down inside that they didn't do it. So how could the justice system convict them? But unfortunately, that happens a lot, you know, more than I feel like it should, you know? So it's always that sentiment of like, if you're there, you have to be there for a reason, you know?
Well, and that's one of the problems, apparently, that juries, that there is a bias in juries, an unconscious bias. Mm-hmm. If you have been charged, then you must have done something. There's this awful thought, rather than the other way around. And then when you get suborned perjury of our friend Jerry Trump, Jerry Trump's a convicted sex offender.
Mm-hmm. But this was wild to me. Like, this was, well, I mean, going back to Kevin Crane for a second, I think it really highlights how we structure our entire justice system. And indeed, I think our government system, I don't want to get too political here, but we structure it in this term of like, we shouldn't call it you won a case, because it really sets it up to treat it like a sports event. And I really like the sense I get from Kevin Crane is like, he doesn't actually care whether justice is being served. He just wants to win.
The win, yes.
And I think this is one thing I feel like needs to be reformed on a deep level. And we think about it like, even extending like out to politics, it's not really, we shouldn't call it you won, because it sets up like the other guys are losers. And
agreed. And people use these type of cases, prosecutors use these type of cases to springboard their careers to be, Judge Crane, I mean, Kevin Crane is now a judge.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is what happens when you prioritize getting a conviction over actually finding out who did that and being absolutely stone sure that you have the person who committed the crime that you are charging somebody with, you know?
Yeah. And it's like, look at me. I did a great thing. I got this guy convicted for years and years on the flimsiest shred of evidence. That makes me good at my job.
And when Kathleen Zellner comes in as Ryan's defense attorney, she takes up the case. She has a very, just startling to camera where she says, it shouldn't be this hard. Once something is done and done incorrectly, it shouldn't be this hard to undo it. But as we see again and again with wrongful convictions, you can have all the new evidence, you can have confessions from the person who actually did it, you can have proof of suborned perjury. But once you are incarcerated, the system is extremely reluctant to let you go. And exactly. That's something that where Zellner agrees with you, Jess, it needs reform, like the system needs to be reformed.
And it's along those lines of like winning and losing. If you admit you're wrong, this is toxic masculinity. Yeah. I can't admit we were wrong about something, because that will make people not trust us. It will make us feel less manly. It's just staggering. Like, it's very clear that there's something. Not the evidence. Yeah, the evidence exactly. is very clear. And especially like with Jerry Trump being like blatantly fed this story that definitely did not happen, and
right.
how hard it was to even get him to like come back and say that it didn't happen.
Yeah. Yes. Jerry Trump's, even his initial story to me does not seem like it would be credible in a sense. Like, even if he said like, cause he originally said like, oh yeah, Shauna came and grabbed me. We saw two figures, but I couldn't clearly see them. But then the next thing is like, oh, I saw them in the newspaper and I was like, oh yeah, those are the guys. But normally that type of evidence is excluded, because if you see them in the newspaper, you're biased already, because you would see a headline, you would see the article. This is why in Ryan's initial trial, Jerry Trump said, oh, I saw the pictures first. And when I saw the pictures, I was like, those are the guys, before saying that he read the headline or the article. Because if he had said, I read the article, I saw the headline, and I saw the two guys' pictures, and that's when I was like, oh yeah, it was those two guys, that should have been a sticking point for the defense. Like, you cannot have a witness that's on the stand who's pointing at your defendant, who basically got it from a newspaper article. Like, you just cannot have that. So again, him saying like it was folded in a way that it makes the story plausible and can't get it thrown out by the judge. A judge should have probably thrown out this testimony, to be quite honest. But it was said in such a way that it was let through. I don't know why they didn't challenge this testimony by Jerry Trump.
Well, it was the counsel that we had.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu. Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
But the thing is that later, we're going to skip ahead a little bit. There's a couple more. There's an evidentiary hearing where a lot of this stuff comes out, and then that they lose that. And then with Kathleen Zellner, they have a habeas hearing. And it's at this hearing that Shauna Shauna has come forward and told Bill Ferguson, Ryan's father, that she outright told Kevin Crane that it was 100% not Ryan, very courageous of her to come forward. Now she's in court saying that Jerry Trump, who's converted to Mormonism and is slightly guilted by Kathleen Zellner, who says, oh, my grandmother was a Mormon, you have to tell the truth. And he is shaking and crying, and he tells the story of the suborned perjury, that it was Kevin Crane who told him, plus who made up the story of the folded envelope that the wife sent him. And we think about this type of eyewitness evidence anyway, just lensing way, way, way out. Eyewitnesses are notoriously unreliable. Uh-huh. And if I may just jump to Stephen Avery for a moment, seeing as we're in the Kathleen Zellner territory. His first conviction, I remember hearing about this, is before Making a Murder, years before, Radiolab did an article with the woman who originally accused him of rape. When she was being, I'm sorry, everybody, warning, when she was being raped, she thought she was going to die, but she also thought, I will look at this man, this stranger, and I will imprint his face on my memory so that if I live, I am able to identify him. She did live. She saw Stephen Avery, or she was shown Stephen Avery. She 100% knew that it was Stephen Avery. That was his first conviction, and he went to jail for that. Another man was found to actually be the rapist, and when she saw him, she had no memory of him. She looked at him and just knew she'd never seen him. This misidentification has haunted this woman, which is why we never hear from her in any of the Making a Murderer shows, because she will not speak on the record anymore. But it's a very interesting interview with her on Radiolab, if you can source it. My point, and I do have one, is that you would think if anybody could remember a face, it would be this woman under these circumstances. But in fact, no, it's very hard. I myself have been held up at knife point. I was shown an array and videotaped while I was looking at it. It was all very well done by New South Wales Police. Well done, New South Wales Police. They did get him, but because he was shocked by one of his friends, not because I could identify him. I looked at a series of photos of men who were sort of similar to each other, and none of them jumped out at me. So even in my own experience, eyewitnesses are notoriously
Sarah,
unreliable.
Jess, can y'all remember what y'all were doing 3 years ago today? Like that, you know, that it's so true. Like, you know, eyewitness testimony is really hard. It's very hard. That's why you shouldn't totally base a case off of that. Like, you know, the prosecutor went into this case telling the jury up front there would be no physical evidence, but we don't need it because we have eyewitness testimony, which I think, I mean, he did a good job of setting the expectations. You see what I'm saying? Like, because that's what it is. You know, most juries are looking for some physical evidence. If you tell them up front, hey guys, there won't be any physical evidence, you're at least setting your bar pretty low, I think, here. And I just want to say that the way the documentary is structured is we get the original trial. They basically, all of it is taped. So we get the trial pared down. Then we get his conviction. He's sentenced to, it was life without the possibility of parole, plus
30 years for the murder, 10 years for the robbery.
Thank you, Sarah. 30 years for the murder, 10 years for the robbery. And then
death was on the table.
Right. Okay, that's what it was. Thank you so much, Sarah. Mm-hmm. Then we get this middle section where basically it's Ryan's father, Bill, is continuously working on his case, tiredly, doggedly working on his case. And then, like Sarah pointed out, we had Zellner come in. Her plus Mr. Ferguson made a great team. So they got rejected at the appeals meeting, because they point out in the documentary, it's really hard to get your case overturned in the court where you're convicted in, which, again, ugh. But then they have the habeas meeting. And then we get to the rest of the him getting out and all that. But I want to just kind of kind of take it back a little bit and go to how Bill Ferguson really did such an amazing job really advocating for his son in order to get to the point where they got to at the habeas meeting. So Bill Ferguson basically had all of the documents in his garage. He pored over everything. He went back to the crime scene multiple times, so many times to the point where he was basically giving a crime scene tour where people would come up to him. He'd have bus of kids walking them through this crime scene tour. This is how he got Shauna Orndt, the janitor, to talk to him, to confess that she had told the prosecutor that Ryan wasn't there. You know, it's basically him doggedly following up leads that the police didn't do. Like, that's the only reason why I want to come back to this, is because the police truly didn't even try to follow up on half of these leads. Like, a lot of it is the prosecutor, but what were the police doing? You know, one only consistency in Chuck's statement was, hey, we saw our friend Dallas Mallory at this corner of this light, right? That was basically in every statement that he made. We saw our friend Dallas Mallory. We saw our friend Dallas Mallory. Nobody talked to Dallas Mallory. You know, Bill and Catherine reached out to Dallas Mallory. Dallas was like, I wasn't there that night. I didn't see Chuck that night. I definitely didn't see Ryan that night. And they figured that out because Bill was at the crime scene at 1 a.m. and he realized that there was a blinking yellow light at the corner that Chuck had said Dallas was at. And if it's a blinking yellow light, it couldn't have been the red light that Chuck said that Dallas was at a red light. They stopped, they talked for a minute, and then he went home. So that's what prompted Bill and Catherine to reach out to Dallas. Dallas said he wasn't there, but Dallas also didn't have a license, y'all. He didn't have a license. He didn't have a car. He didn't have a license because he had a previous DWI. So they did no follow up to some of these material witnesses, and we'll keep going through some of the inconsistencies and the no follow up. But just this right here, I mean, come on. Just what is
Dallas
happening?
When I fell in love with Dallas was when he said, oh, and Chuck said I was in a car with two females in the back. And he just looks at the camera and goes, no, that couldn't have been me. yes. Mm. So, yes, he's an exculpatory witness. I like that word very much, and just meaning someone who, rather than positively identifying you that you did it, it's positively saying it was not as the story has been told. He appears at the habeas meeting, hearing as well.
Yes. We also get, Bill Ferguson realizes, hey, has anybody talked to Jerry Trump's wife? Why did she send him that article? Yeah. Why'd she send him that article? Bill Ferguson tracks her down. She's like, no, I never.
Sorry to interrupt. He says he's seen enough Perry Mason. So
yes. Yes.
He approached Mrs. Trump with the figure eight.
Yes.
Had you heard of this figure eight thing, Jess? I hadn't heard of it before.
I think I have. It is kind of, it's a storytelling trope in the crime genre. Mm. Like, I think this is something I'm sure I've heard it on Law and Order at some point.
Yeah. Right. So
familiar.
You hit the question, you move away from it, you come back.
And then
back
you
to
come back and ask it a different way.
At a different way. And if every time you hit that question, which I suppose is at the little waist of the figure eight, if they answer the same way each time, then they're telling the truth. Yeah. And if it shifts, then they're not. And I thought this was very clever.
Yeah. This is also a psychometrics thing. Like, if you are giving someone a psychological test, you will frequently ask the same question a lot of different ways. So you can't game it.
A lot of those Wonderlic tests or tests you would take like for a job, like a job interview. Yeah,
right.
Exactly. So Mrs. Trump, former Mrs. Trump, I don't think they were married anymore. she basically says, I never sent him that article. I've never seen that article.
I did not cleverly fold down the page such that he could not see the headline.
Exactly. Which, again, it just makes you think that they did not follow up on some of these inconsistencies because they did not want these inconsistencies to
Well, as we find out from Jerry, Kevin Crane himself made up the story of the the envelope. So he definitely wouldn't want to go and speak to Mrs. Trump. But why wasn't the defense doing so, doing exactly what Bill Ferguson, private citizen, manages to do on his own?
That's a great point. That is a great point. So all of these inconsistencies are presented at the habeas hearing.
Yes, that's right.
And this habeas hearing, correct me if I'm wrong, it was turned down.
Judge Green. So they had an evidentiary hearing, which failed. Then they have this habeas hearing once Kathleen Zellner gets her marvelous nails into the case, and they appear before Judge Green, and we have film of her in action. It's absolutely fantastic. She has a whole theatrical thing with the folded newspaper article, which she shows Kevin Crane. But Judge Green brings down the no answer. She is expecting, we have film of her in contemporaneously expecting that the answer will be yes to vacate the evidence. So she is completely shocked when it doesn't. So then they go to the higher court where they submit all the documents, but you've only got an oral argument of 15 minutes before this court, and you don't know what part of the argument against the opinion of Judge Green, you don't know which part of that they're going to quiz you on, so you have to be prepared to answer absolutely everything, and they will quiz you on one thing and you have 15 minutes, which also seems like in a complex case, you have 15 minutes. Did you know this 15-minute rule, Jess? I certainly didn't know it.
No, I've not heard about this at all.
Me neither.
This was like giving me flashbacks to like speech and debate team.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Like this is deep law. Like this is, you know, deep, like higher appeals court law that, you know, not my forensic science training did not touch any of this.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking,
I was very confused by that as well.
It is similar to if you argue before the Supreme Court, you get 1 hour and that's all you get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. I suppose the idea is that you have prepared your brief thoroughly. The judges, there are three judges on the district court, this district court that sat, they have read everything and thought about it and understood it. So I suppose they're not asking you to make your entire case in 15 minutes. They are perhaps asking you a question for clarity on anything that they need clarity on. So this is the judgment that comes down that not that he'll get a new trial, but that the conviction is vacated, which means that he does not have to stand trial again. He never did it. It was never right. This is 9.5 years in jail. One time when Bill's just spoken to Ryan, he tells him that a man was killed in jail the night before. And Bill even tells us at any time in that 9.5 years, Ryan could have been killed. Ryan gets $11 million in a civil suit against the Missouri police. So people of Missouri, rise up. Lucky. They just spent your money. That wasn't the police's $11 million. That was your $11 million. The Ferguson family is offered $10,000 reward for tips that can solve the case. I'm just going to do this and then we'll go back and talk about the piece as a whole. Charles Erickson, he's now Charles, no longer Chuck. He's set for parole in January of next year. He is still convicted of the crime, even though Ryan conviction has been vacated. And Kevin Crane is a circuit court judge for the 13th Circuit Court of Missouri. And the good people of Missouri elected him in 2006, re-elected him in 2012. And after this documentary came out, which showed that he suborned perjury, he was re-elected in 2018. So he is still on the bench.
Yeah. Well, you know, because once you get on the bench here in America, a lot of due diligence isn't done when it comes to voting. So you're like, oh, that guy's been here for a while, and you just vote to keep him in there. So that is the documentary. But I do want to stop down on Ryan here for a minute, because throughout the documentary, Bill Ferguson, of course, he's so dogged about getting him out. He has this car that says Free Ryan that he rolls around with that has Ryan's big old face on it. But I think the documentary does a good job of not losing the fact that Ryan is in jail. Like, while all of this is happening, he's in jail, losing the best years of his life for a crime he did not commit. So for when they're talking about Ryan's escapades in jail, that sounds like the worst word for it, but they have like animated montages, which I think is just very well done. This is one of the things that I really liked about the documentary. It kind of breaks it up a little bit just to show you what the stakes are. In a sense, you know, we're going from one thing, like one hearing to another hearing. And in between it, we get a montage of how Ryan talks about what it's like actually being in jail. And the scariest thing about hearing all the sounds and hearing the cries for help and all of the really graphic things. But then he goes back in one section, he talks about how we get his father talking about how they're so close. They play basketball together every day. And then Ryan talking about in prison, how him knowing how to play basketball and being very skilled at basketball essentially helped him survive in there because he was so good at it. He was able to gain respect so people wouldn't test him because he was really good at basketball. We even got a small little aside of him making jail pizza, which I couldn't even tell you the ingredients if I tried. It sounded like a heartburn on a platter. But, you know, he was just talking about little things to you know, make it a little bit bearable while in there. What did we think about these tidbits with Ryan here?
Well, this reminded me of nothing so much as Orange is the New Black. Like, not necessarily the series, but the memoir it's based on. There are a lot of asides similar to this about, like, the skills that helped the protagonist survive. And there is a prison recipe in there for cheesecake that is about as horrific as the prison pizza recipe. And those little like slice of life things, I think, really help add dimension to the story because I think without it, it is even drier. I think this documentary on the whole does sometimes come off as very dry. And it would be even drier without this little bit of color from Ryan about what his life is like and how it is different from the life he imagined.
Yeah, I mean, I think the animations they're surprising and they are beautifully done. And we get them illustrating his voiceover better than a reenactment by far, because it is about his life of the mind as well. He talks about reading books. He read 3 books a week and he was always preparing himself to get out. We see some talking head interviews with him while he's still in prison, and he talks after the final hearing like, I'll either be out in 6 weeks or I'll still be here in 6 years. And you can see his attempt to always think that he will be out and therefore what preparations he need. And I think it's these moments with Ryan, especially the voiceovers with the grey on grey on grey moving animation, that really elevate this property beyond just a sort of a 60-minute segment or whatever it might be. Well made, though, the rest of it is. And the intriguing thing is we do get him sometime after his release in a supermarket talking about how completely unprepared he is to live in the world.
Yeah.
And the very thing that he tried for 10 years to make sure that he wasn't institutionalized, to make sure that he was preparing for the outside world, had not at that time been particularly successful. And I think this is also a great note because we're all cheering and happy that he's out, and yay Kathleen Zellner, and yay Bill Ferguson, who continues now to consult on wrongful conviction cases and help families to investigate them. But we have Ryan alone in a supermarket, and there was something so quotidian about the basket over his arm and shopping. And I thought, yes, you've been eating prison pizza. You've probably never done a proper adult shop in your life. Who knows what you're eating as a student? And here you are in this brightly coloured vegetable aisle with strawberries. I thought it was a beautiful selection of a place, considering that we saw his life in Grey before. Jess, is this the man that you met on Amazing Race? How do you feel? Where's the connection?
The most interesting thing to me is that they almost never talk about Ryan's background on Amazing Race. It is the hook that gets him on the show and he mentions it. But really, the Ryan you get to know, for one thing, the partner he brings on Amazing Race is completely outshines him personality wise. And I do not blame Ryan one bit for being a little bit reserved. I think that's probably how he always was, but his life circumstances have made him more so. So he takes a backseat to Dusty for a lot of the Amazing Race. And there is a mention, of course, of how his life has gone, but they spend almost an equal amount of time on his background that the film covers, his unconventional upbringing. He grew up, he was born in Australia and his family traveled around and his parents traveled the world together. And it turned into this multi-year odyssey. And that almost feels more germane to his journey on the Amazing Race. Mm-hmm. But, there is some elements of sweetness to his ability to do this thing that everybody dreams about and how it is something he wouldn't have envisioned ever being able to do. But mm-hmm. you almost forget that that's the guy as you're watching Amazing Race.
Yeah, I was struck particularly by there's a moment where Dusty, his partner, who may or may not be a dog, we're not quite sure, Dusty is doing, a task I would just, I don't know how I would do it, a huge circle of stones and you have to turn over the stone to find a coin. Everybody else has done it. Dusty is there, very dog-like, hands and knees, overturning stone after stone. You would go mad because they weren't allowed to, I think from the rules, they weren't allowed to turn over a stone and leave it face up, so you knew which one you mm-hmm. looked at. They all had to be replaced. And Ryan is, and it's sort of an amphitheatre, and he's at the top of the amphitheatre and he just really calmly and quietly, because if you don't know Amazing Race, you are not allowed to help your partner materially in the task. But he says to Dusty, just come up here. And he gets Dusty, calls him, come on, boy.
Here, boy.
Come here. To come up to the top of this amphitheater and just to look out. It's raise your eyes to the horizon. And we should all do this more. We should all look up more. We should all look out more. And they look out over this incredible vista and there's this, almost romantic, not in the sexual sense, but romantic moment of these two young men, still young, looking out over this vista. And you can't help but think, what does that mean to Ryan, even now, some years later, to be able to stand here in this foreign land and look out over a vista with a very trusted friend. So yes, Jess, you're right. It's not mentioned a lot, but I think we supply those moments because Ryan takes a back seat.
Yeah, they try not to make it about that because it's not really, they don't want it to take over the story, but you can, there is a lot of subtext, especially in moments like that.
Mm. Yeah. Exactly. And I think from what I heard, I don't know if this is true, Jess, maybe you can confirm this, but I heard that Bill Ferguson was going to be Ryan's partner, but Ryan and his dad were going to run Amazing Race together, but then he might not have been he didn't get medically cleared or something like that. So it ended up being Dusty instead. Have you heard anything about that?
I had heard that. I don't have any confirmation of it.
Gotcha.
But that would certainly, makes a lot of sense. And I think the story becomes a very different one. And also, as much as I thought Bill Ferguson was a great personality in this documentary, I think we are better off for having had Dusty in our lives.
Oh my God, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Love Bill, but dry is exactly the word for Bill. I think potentially like that prior to the 10 years he spent trying to free his son, but certainly made so by this sort of relentless, I mean, Leslie, Ryan's mother, does talk about he had to be doing something at every moment to feel like, again, his masculinity, to feel like he was actively doing something to save Ryan. But yes, the joy of Dusty, I'm very glad that we got that. Love Bill, though, we do.
Yes.
Right,
for sure.
So
I think there's just sort of one last question that we haven't asked. Who killed Kent Heitholt? The documentary does not touch this, and I think that's correct, although we might think, oh, I wanted to know more about that. It really isn't who killed Kent. It's let's see how we can get Ryan out of jail. Right. There is the Mike Boyd theory. I don't know if either of you have heard the Mike Boyd theory. Mike Boyd was a co-worker of Kent Heitholt and is, by his own words, the last person to see Kent alive. He has told six different versions of the story of them leaving at around 2 a.m. He has never been investigated for the crime. And we'll put a link in the show notes to a short 5-minute report from CBS 48 Hours, which will just expand that theory a little bit. We are 100% on this podcast not saying that Mike Boyd is in any way associated or culpable in any way. We are mentioning what is called the Mike Boyd theory, and we'll link to that 48 Hours report.
I mean, I'll say it again. I don't think the subject of who killed him is germane to the plot of the documentary, because it's, you know, it's really like, it could have been anybody, but it's definitely not this guy.
And exactly. And it's just kind of like, and they need more investigation, because everything that they have, it's just, they had nothing. They basically fabricated a whole bunch of stuff to get Ryan and to get Chuck. So like, they would need to go back. And I this Mike Boyd theory is very interesting, because like he said that he last saw Kent alive in the parking lot between 2:12 a.m. and then 2:26 a.m. And then, but it was at 2:26 a.m. that they had called 911 and that he was like found. So it's like, that's like that only leaves a 6 to 8 minute, I think it was 6 to 8 minute window between the last time that Mike Boyd saw Kent alive and when I think either Shauna or called 911 or 911 got there. I wasn't really clear. And then it also is very interesting, because if they said they saw those two guys, right? They said they saw two guys around Kent's car, and what Shauna said was they saw two teenage college age guys around Kent's car, and they yell out to them, "Hey, somebody's hurt over here, man," or something like that. Let me just make sure. Let me get the exact quote. I thought I had it. I'm sorry. But yeah.
That sounds right. That sounds right.
Yeah, but basically the two guys called out to them, like, "Somebody's hurt over here," and then they just ran down an alley. That's really interesting to me. You know what I'm saying? Because it's like, were those two people that Shauna and Jerry saw not even, you know, affiliated with the murder? Were they just poking around? Whose unidentified fingerprints are there? Like, there's so much that needs to be answered. And, you know, we're not going to, there's no answers on this podcast. I'm sorry, guys, y'all are excited.
But I think, Jess, you're right. I mean, and this is, again, one of the beauties of the documentary. It doesn't try to do anything but a story of not who done it, but who didn't done it, and how to untangle that wrongful conviction. So it very clearly sets out its markers and trots along with it. I like this documentary very much, and we just give our ratings of 1 to 5 magnifying glasses as to how much we liked this the thing we're talking about, 5 being the best. What would be your number of magnifying glasses for Dream Killer?
I mean, I would give it 4. It doesn't it's not a wild ride per se, but it's certainly, it's thought provoking. I think it's well produced. It's definitely, if you're interested in the subject matter, I don't think you can do any better.
Yeah. Mari, what about you?
I think I'm going to give it a three. Let's go with a 3.5 because I do think that it is indeed well produced, like Jess said. But yeah, it can be dry. It's not exciting, you know what I'm saying? But I do think that they did the first 10 minutes very well. I think that they did it in a way that it very well like hooked me, in a sense. And I think I like the way that they actually laid out the story. I do feel like there might have been a few things missing, but overall, I'll say a 3.5 because it's not the best thing that I've seen. It's not the best true crime documentary or wrongful conviction documentary that I've seen, but it's pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah, I like this very much. I think that the story was clear. The story that the director decides to tell is very clear. We have Bill to narrate it for us. We have a very sympathetic subject in Ryan. I'd be very interested in a wrongful conviction case against a very unattractive person and see how we go. It's certainly, the story is compelling, I think, after the unnecessary showing of the crime scene. I think it sets itself up very well. I think the dryness that Jess mentioned is certainly there. The animation elevates it. And the music was very good as well. I'm looking forward to the Cabbage Patch Kids documentary now, you know, some years later, and perhaps he's honed his craft a little bit more. I'm going with 3.5 magnifying glasses for Dream Killer. So, I mean, as you say, Mari, there are wrongful conviction documentaries that you know, so compelling. And I think the big two, which people will know, and if you haven't seen them, they're sort of required, really. And one is The Thin Blue Line, directed by Errol Morris, who incidentally directed the Elizabeth Holmes Theranos ad. you see him in the documentary actually doing it. Errol, what are you doing? And he's referred to in The Dropout. And the other is The Paradise Lost, a trilogy directed by Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sanofsky. So those are two really to check out if you're interested in wrongful conviction. And we have a listener recommendation. This comes from Nicholas, who would like to inject a little serial killer into our true crime. So he recommends two properties on the Yorkshire Ripper. One is Gordon Burns' 1984 book, Somebody's Husband, Somebody's Son, and also the four-part Netflix series from 2020 called The Ripper. So if you're interested in serial killing, if you're interested in the Yorkshire Ripper, which is a particularly chilling case and certainly looks at British police practices as well, that's an avenue you can explore. Jess, have you got some recommendations for us?
Well, can I give you three?
You can give us 20.
All of them. Well, I'm going to start because I mentioned the Case File podcast up top, and I'm kind of surprised that not everybody in the world is jumping on this the first thing in the morning on Saturday mornings, because this is, for my money, if you were looking to get into true crime and you're looking to learn more about like any classic case, Case File is it. Like, it's just great storytelling, really well put together, and with a focus on Australia because the host is Australian. So, Sarah,
how do I not know it? This is embarrassing.
They did a five part series on Ivan Milat. So that's where, when you mentioned that on the first episode of Crime Scene, I was like, what? Because I just finished listening to like 5 weeks of the Langlo murders. So, I knew all about that. And there are, you know, it's well known cases, and then there's little known cases. They just did a multi-part series on the Zodiac Killer. Maybe the best one is probably the three-part story on Silk Road, which is great because it's not just a murder. It's like an entire, you know, it's, you know, cyber crime and drug dealing, and it's a really great podcast. I definitely, anybody that's into true crime is going to love it. Right. And then I'm going to recommend two books while we're on the subject of wrongful conviction. I think you have to go to Amanda Knox and her memoir is called Waiting to Be Heard. And it is a really interesting deep dive into like the nature of criminal investigations and how police pull confessions out of people and the fragility of memory and all of that. And she's, you know, she's a great writer, and anybody, it's like Brian Ferguson. Anytime you spend more than 5 minutes looking at this case, it's like, how did she spend any time? How did she spend a minute in jail for this? Mm-hmm. So I would recommend that. And then I just finished a book, called Savage Harvest, A Tale of Cannibals, Colonialism, and Michael Rockefeller's Tragic Quest for Primitive Art. That's a mouthful. Mm. The author is Carl Hoffman. And the story behind that is Michael Rockefeller was the 23-year-old son of New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller. And he was an art dealer, an art collector. And he was especially interested in so-called primitive art. So he goes to Indonesia, to the island of Papua, to collect wood carvings from the Asmat tribe. And then he disappears. And the question becomes, what happened to him? Did he drown? Did he die of exposure? Was he killed, murdered, and possibly eaten by these warring factions of Asmat, of Asmat warriors? And then, so Carl Hoffman decides he's going to get to the bottom of this, and he has an agenda, and it's not... I think it's really great if you're going to zoom out and look at like biases and how they inform who tells a story and how they tell a story. It's great on that end. And also, like Dream Killer, it starts out with this really gruesome, like almost like he's describing what he thinks happened in this incredibly graphic and gruesome way, informed by what he has found out about how these people were living in the 1960s. And then he exposes many little biases along the way, but also it's just a really fascinating subject and interesting story. And the art that Michael Rockefeller collected can still be viewed in the Metropolitan Museum today. So I'm going to try to go this weekend and see it. So yeah, I've got very into this book, and it was, you know, lightning fast read, really well done. If you have Amazon Prime, I think you can read it for free. So
if you wait, I'll come with you next weekend.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I love that. Those are my recommendations.
Mari, what about you? What about you? What have you got for us today?
So, of course, I'm going to recommend When They See Us, the Netflix crime drama based on the Central Park Five, known as the Exonerated Five. It is based on the Central Park jogger case. It is the quintessential case of wrongful conviction in my community. You know what I'm saying? As a Black woman, as, you know, knowing that more often than not, wrongfully convicted people are normally Black or Brown here in the U.S., you know, and not only that, but they are less likely to get their convictions overturned. They are less likely, if they do get their convictions overturned, to be paid for the time that they spent in jail. And they are more, we are more often will spend a longer amount of time wrongfully convicted. So, you know, Ryan spending 10 years in jail as compared to some other cases that have where people have spent like 30, 40 plus years in jail wrongfully convicted. And it's not a, you know, it's not a race or anything like that. But When They See Us is one of the greatest like TV series. Ava DuVernay wrote it. It is a limited series. And it is a docudrama, of course, like we talk about here. I don't even know if we call it docudrama. It's a series, and all of the actors do a very good job of going over the case. I think the case is presented very well. I think the acting in that is amazing, and it is very hard to watch. It is very hard to watch for a number of reasons. And if anybody's been listening to me and Chappelle talk about Talk on Atlanta, we talked about it just this past week, how he hasn't watched it. And I don't blame him, because, you know, it runs in us. So we know what happened. We don't need to, you don't need to tell us what happened, but it's great. I suggest it. Also the documentary, the Central Park Five, documentary by, Ken Burns is always a good as well, if you want to go the documentary route. But that is a case that, truly still haunts me. And, I think the story needs to be told so that we're always heavily scrutinizing our justice system and our judicial practices to make sure that they are fair and equitable. But that's it for my recommendations.
Yeah, and of course, wonderful, wonderful properties there. And certainly for New Yorkers, a kind of a seminal and shock case. Well, I mean, I had a friend that I mentioned the Central Park. What are they?
You can say either the Central Park jogger case, or you can talk about the Exonerated Five.
Yeah, the Exonerated Five. Mm-hmm. So I think I was saying that I'd seen the Ken Burns documentary, and it was about the Central Park jogger case. And she said, "Oh yes, those five kids." It's like, no, this is long after they were exonerated, because the press on their conviction was front page, and on their exoneration was buried. And this is another thing that needs to be looked at as well. So yeah, excellent recommendations, and certainly thank you for bringing up those numbers and in terms of the different races.
Most of them had already served their sentence by the time they were exonerated. So it's a lot. So definitely go watch that, because both the documentary and the series do a great job of explaining the case, explaining how justice was not served, and just a need to know if you care about wrongful conviction cases. That is a very need to know case for everybody. Okay, so at Crime Scene, we are eager to hear your feedback and suggestions for future episodes. See, if you suggest it, we might cover it. Look right here. It's happening right now. You can follow Crime Scene on Twitter at Crime Scene RHAP. That's CRIMESEENRHAP. Or email us at CrimeSceneRHAP@gmail.com. Again, that's Crime Scene SEEN. So Jess, what do you have going on? Where can people find you?
You can find me over on Twitter or the gram at Haymaker Hattie. Mm-hmm. And right now I'm covering The Walking Dead and Fear the Walking Dead and all property zombie on Post Show Recaps with Josh Wigler and Chappelle and AJ Mass. Some conglomeration of the four of us is there every week talking about what's happened on Fear the Walking Dead. And then I have other small one-off podcasts here and there, and just sitting around waiting for the next season of Amazing Race, really.
Yeah. Sarah, how about you?
So you can follow me on Twitter at Sarah Carradine. I just did a Survivor podcast, if you can believe that, me talking about Survivor, filthy casual that I am, over on Silent Podcasts with Gia Worthy and the Real Weird Sisters. We had lots of fun. And I've just wrapped up the Bridgerton coverage on Post Show Recaps with The Dark Walk, which is me, Kirsten McInnes, Geneva Guadalupe, and Sasha Joseph. So if you follow me on Twitter, I am not shy about saying all the things that I'm doing, so you definitely won't miss out. Mari, what about you? Where can people find you?
Okay, you can always find me on Twitter at Mari Talks Too Much. That's two, like the number two. Every week here with you, Sarah, for Crime Scene. And of course, like I said, me and Chappelle are over on Post Show Recaps covering season 3 of Atlanta. So it's been very fun, but also very draining this season. So go check that out over on Post Show Recaps. But you know what else you should check out? You should check out the Hot Mess Express. The Hot Mess Express is en route to a new destination with season 9 of the 90 Day Fiancé podcast. So, of course, our fearless conductor, Pooya Zambakili, has got us covered. So who is going to be the worst couple? Who will rise up their weekly power rankings? These are just a few questions that Pooya will answer weekly with an amazing cast of guests coming throughout the season to talk about the wild ride that is 90 Day Fiancé. I will be the guest.
So
make sure you are following the 90 Day Fiancé podcast so you can hear when both me and Sarah come up. And you can subscribe by going to robhasawebsite.com/90dayfeed so you can keep up with the Hot Mess Express. So what's coming up next on Crime Scene, Sarah?
Well, next time on Crime Scene, a friend of the pod and true crime maven Sarah D. Bunting is returning to discuss the painter and the Thief. She brought us this property and we jumped on it with both feet because it's absolutely fascinating. It's available in Australia on SBS On Demand, and in the US it's on Hulu. So watch it and send us your questions and comments for next time.
Thanks to Will from America for the theme music and to Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes. Until next time, case closed.